Welcome to Bald Talk, the podcast where, as of late, one bald comedian interviews bald actors, reactors, extroverts, introverts, wallflowers, social butterflies, and nearly anyone bald about being bald. I am flying solo yet again, but that just means that I have today's guest all to myself, and I will share him with you, dear listeners. He is a brilliant, hilarious, and gifted actor known for his work on The Drew Carey Show, American Housewife, Outsourced, Veep, Better Things, Napoleon Dynamite, Office Space, and the list goes on, and I'm not exaggerating. The list is intimidating. From my expert point of view, he's not officially bald, but he's putting in the receding work, and he's on the path. We welcome him with open arms. Please welcome Dietrich Bader.
Oh, Dietrich. Thank you. That was great. I love that introduction. Thank you, Brad.
Yeah.
And
right?
No. I am definitely. I have a bald spot back here, which is kind of enormous.
You do?
I do. I have just enough hair for a hair lady or gentleman to spray my head and make it look like I have a full head of hair.
Do they spray or do they sprinkle in the charcoal dust?
It's a combination now. It's, because the technology has changed.
Yes.
So they do like kind of paint, sort of a paint-like thing. And then on top of that, they do what's called topics, which is, as you were alluding to, it is chopped up very fine hair that they put hairspray down. Then they spray the thing on, which is kind of chopped up hair. It gives it a matte finish. I call it bald be gone.
It's very, bald be gone, it's very regional theater. Like, the technology behind it is very, like, we burned a Bible and we used the ash on your head to kind of, like, cover it up if you have gray hair or something.
It's definitely that.
Yeah, I've not, I'm at the point now where they're just, like, it is that dance with the hair and makeup people where they're, like, sit down in a hair's chair and they look at me like, you're perfect.
Yeah, you're so good.
I get it.
You're just good. Do you ever do a rug thing? Do you ever like wear a wig?
I did one for a commercial series recently.
Okay.
Because it was me and Rob Corddry. We're in it together.
Oh, okay.
You can't have two baldies. Oddly enough, I always want to. I would love to do a very involved wig work.
The two, I have a very high hairline. From, I guess, like the region in Germany that my family's from, that this hairline is fairly common. It's always been this far back ever since I was really little. Yeah, and I've got an absolutely enormous forehead. The two biggest parts I've had in big movies, so Beverly Hillbillies and oh my God, Miss Congeniality 2. For both of them, I had like a wig that lowered my hairline about an inch and a half, 2 inches.
Was that your choice or their request?
That was a request, and I was totally into it. And oddly enough, although there was an enormous span between those two pictures, it was the same wig maker. Her name was Renata.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's in the valley, and she was happy to see me.
Welcome back.
Yeah, the first time I saw her, she was like, "Oh, why would they want to cover up that beautiful German forehead?" And I was like, "I don't know. I don't pay the bills around here, so." Yeah. It is.
It's a lighting
distracting
problem.
Like you see that.
It's a lighting problem.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a billboard. It's like walking billboard. I always think like
I find that fascinating though that they ask just like can we just lower it a little bit
because it's a little much. I get it. I mean, you know, it is an enormous forehead. It's very culturally specific to Southern Germany. And that one region, apparently, it's so attractive funny. There, but anywhere else, it just looks weird.
Wow. So there was some inappropriate pairing going on in that one region, like just centuries ago. And everyone's paid the price since then.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. My dad had it, and all of my uncles, my two brothers. It's like, it's just a thing, which is, I mean, you know, it's fine. I think, actually, one of the biggest things in my career has been the size of my forehead and the placement of my hairline. I think it's such a huge choice stylistically for a show, and they don't want to broach the idea of a wig with me that I think I think I lose a lot of roles that way, where they're like, it's distracting. It's just distracting.
I mean, okay, so now we're in the thick of it because that just what you said, in any sort of margin of error or sort of like error, I can point to like, okay, well, here's the doubt bringer.
Yeah.
In losing a job or, you know, knowing you did an amazing job, but it just like physically you're not, you know, they want a Camry and you are a bicycle.
Yeah,
it's
totally.
Just like, it's not going
to
fit.
Oh yeah. 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 No, I used to get it all the time when people would go, oh, that forehead. And I'd go, yeah, I mean, it's there. It's part of my head.
Yeah. But in what ways has it, you are a working actor. Like you work constantly, you know, you're established. You're definitely that guy, you know,
that guy.
You and I, and, yeah, you and I ended up on somebody's sort of self-made list that a bunch of people sent to me. It's like, have you seen this? You're on that guy list. I was like, oh, cool. Oh,
cool. Yeah.
But it is.
I'm that guy. Yeah.
But for me, I was like, great. That is basically sort of like that's like a good Google review for your business.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. You're a reliable player and you work enough where people know who you are.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm totally into it. I mean, it's better to be known than not known. That's for sure.
Totally.
Yeah.
But it is a character actor thing. And actor most often implies a different hairline.
That's right. Like, that's right.
If you're a female character actor, they're just like, you know, homely best friend or whatever.
Oh, totally. It's funny because, you know, when I grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, where I came from, and in my high school, I was actually kind of a good-looking guy. I came out here, and it was like, who is this guy? Like, he's so weird-looking. Because they're like genetic freaks that move out here that are so handsome that you just can't take your eyes off them. Like you know, it's like early days, I knew Brad Pitt, just really early days. Mm-hmm. And we used to play volleyball together. Anyway,
volleyball.
Yeah, it's like you play volleyball, but it's in a, I think it was a racquetball court. Anyway, you can play against the walls and off the ceiling. The only place the ball can't hit is the floor.
Oh,
it's very fast paced.
Terrifying.
Anyway, yeah, it was really fun. I couldn't do it now. My knees would never be able to handle it. But you even as a straight guy, you can't take your eyes off him because he's like so gorgeous and he looks like he's from another planet. You know, you're like,
totally.
Well,
he's grown in a lab.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing. He has government research that's gone.
Yeah.
Right,
and that's what it takes in Hollywood for you to be, you know, at all attractive.
Right.
Because it's like,
I mean, the only saving grace is most often they're short. You know what I mean?
Yes. So not Brad, but most of them. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, most of them are sort of like, or they're 90% head if you see them.
Yeah, totally. I know.
Just these like Easter Island kind of like figurines.
It's funny who's short and who isn't short. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger is a lot shorter than you'd think he'd be. Like for some reason, I thought he would be like, I'm 6'2". I thought he would be like 6'5", like a giant.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
And then
I
saw him at a premiere. My wife and I, we were walking in back of him, you know, and so. Like with the angle of the theater, we're walking out. He was actually like still shorter than me.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was like, she goes, there's Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I go, no, can't be.
No,
that's not going to be. So, and I honestly didn't believe it until I like leaned my head up way up. And then I peered around his shoulder. I went like, and looked at him and I was like, hey, because then he looked at me like, what are you doing? Of course, naturally, who wouldn't do it?
And then you panicked and said, you're much shorter than
just
life
like,
than I thought.
Hiya, hi. Like, just to make it more awkward.
Hiya, hi, hi, hi. How you doing? Hey, how are you? Thanks for running us.
Yeah, I didn't play it off at all. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things, the beauty standard, it also applies to men. You know, they expect you to be a certain way. You know, the days of Humphrey Bogart are. But at the same time, there were the Humphrey Bogarts and there was also the Errol Flynn and the Tyrone Power existed at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, they had, and Gary Cooper, of course, Cary Grant. There were always like some genetic freaks around here who were just so gorgeous and still could act. I mean, you know, Brad, for example, we've been just talking about Brad, is great. I mean, he's a fabulous actor.
Yeah.
So it's nothing
actor.
Against him. It's just, you know, I mean, my guy, he's a freak. That's all I'm saying.
But it's funny, like it is. There's such classification, or sort of like, you know, you get slotted into certain types of roles, and because you are the embodiment of an idea, you know, for a project or something,
right?
And most of the ideas around sort of like a big forehead or a bald head, kind of punchliney, kind of list status,
you know? All the bald jokes and everything. I remember working with. the pilot, actually, that my wife and I met on, the actor who played my dad was Bob Picardo. Do you know Bob at all?
I don't,
Oh, he's a lovely guy. He was on Star Trek and anyway, really, really wonderful actor. Played my dad and completely bald. And when he was cast, there were no bald jokes. And then there was one bald joke on the first run through. And I looked over and Bob was like, and I go, what's going on? He goes, the gates have opened. And I didn't get it at the time because I just didn't get it, you know? And I mean, I knew what he was saying, but I didn't know that it was really going to happen. And he was 100% right. There were then like at least one ball joke in every single scene. Like a family member would bring up your hair loss all the time.
Yeah, totally, totally. Just like any connection, just like slowly breaking down your reserves of dignity.
Right, exactly. And he was and no, he was totally, he was completely right. But
Was that a multicam or was that a?
Those were back in the days of multicam. I mean, you know, there's still some multicams, but that was a multicam.
That feels like very multicam.
Totally.
Fruit to pick. You know what I mean?
And I will say, the audience loved them. They love the bald jokes.
It is bald. I mean, to put it in the parlance of today, bald shaming is totally accepted.
Oh, completely.
Like, it seems like everything else is off the table.
Yeah.
Totally. We keep getting the hits.
And I have done, as you probably noticed on Twitter, I have this recurring joke where I said, how's my hair? Like I ask all the time, you know?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say the way that you found yourself in this position was my girlfriend. I hate Twitter and I'm on there, but I don't do anything.
Yeah.
She is active on it. And she's like, Dietrich Bader on August 6, 2021, just tweeted, I miss my hair. And she is like, you should get him on the show.
Yeah.
And she followed the thread that happened around it and stuff.
I used to have a fantastic head of hair and the vast majority of it has fallen out. And, I mean, I was both kidding and not kidding. You know, it's like I do actually miss my hair. I miss having a full head of hair. I enjoyed having it. You know, I was able to, when it was really full, it could cover part of my enormous forehead. I didn't have a bald spot that I am very self-conscious about, if I'm completely honest. And I know part of this podcast is about insecurities. And I do have an insecurity about it. Like I'm worried if I were to go out and people take a picture of the back of my head. Like, I think about that and it's weird and vain and strange, but it is something that I do think about. Cause I'm like, oh, I don't want anybody to know I'm bald. And it's like, why? What difference does it make? Really?
The weird thing is, I mean, trust me, I spend a lot of time thinking about the back of my head.
Yeah.
And just for me, I mean, when did it start for you? Like, when did you start to shed?
Probably when I was in my mid to late 30s.
Okay.
I'd say right at the end of the Drew Carey show, it really started. Like, I'd wake up and there'd be hair on my pillow. There's now no longer hair on my pillow, but for
because you got a dark pillow that
I got a hair pillow. It started then, and I was like, "What's happening?" You know, I just didn't. Mm-hmm. There would be like lots of hair on my pillow every morning, and it just over about a year, it really got thin, and then once I turned 50, I'm 55 now. The bald spot really became prominent. Like you could see it in pictures really far away. There would be like, you know, this spot.
Isn't that the worst?
Yeah.
Isn't it just like, it just, this, it becomes a white dot in the middle of some beautiful image. It's
Well, it's the thing. There's some like hiking images of that my son took when we were in, where were we? In the Chamonix region of France, hiking in Mont Blanc. And it's beautiful scenery. And I mean, it's spectacular scenery. But every time I see his pictures, I'm like, oh, there's my spot. They got my spot right there.
That one bit of like visual pollution. For
and I wish I could get past it, but I don't think I mean, someday I can, but I'm sure. But it's not yet. And it's interesting that you're doing a whole show about this because it is sort of, in a, in a micro way, it's super fascinating because it's like the vanity of men or accepting. And I don't know. It's a complicated thing, actually.
Yeah. And it's strange because I think, you know, objectively, men have it so easy in like every regard.
Every,
you know what I mean?
Single way.
Every regard. We have all the power.
Yes,
we
especially
have
white
all,
men. Yeah. White straight men. It's like we got 30 points. The game's to 100.
Yeah. And our bodies like hang in there much longer. We have more value in other in sort of social estimation of like what your age means and stuff.
Yeah.
And so there, sometimes doing this podcast, it feels a little, it's a little bit like, shut up.
You know? Yeah, of course.
Quit whining.
Yeah, of course.
But
yeah.
At the same time, to me, it's this thing of like, I've been losing my hair since I was 17.
Oh, young. Wow.
So it's just been this like, just, I it is in keeping with global warming. Like I've just been seeing the kind of decay and stuff. And I've gone through different waves of it and stuff. And oddly, I still have a hang up, even in doing this. Normally my co-host Charlie, he's into being bald. He's like, I don't care.
No, does he shave the rest of his head or does he have the side?
He shaves it. He shaves it pretty like almost to the skin and stuff. And
I'd be interested to see what the delineation is between those that are really comfortable being bald and shave their heads and those that are uncomfortable and don't shave their heads. You know what I mean? Like, I wonder how many. Because it's like you're just holding on. It's not like you're doing a comb over, obviously, but it's like you're holding on to what you have still. And but I don't see any problem with that. It's like it is.
I don't either. Like I think it works for me.
Yeah.
And but then I mean, truly, right now it is in keeping with just aging stuff.
Yeah.
It's sort of like because I just got used to like, all right, this is what I am. You know, this is how it looks.
Yeah.
And thankfully, my girlfriend's like really into it. She's like, I love it when your hair gets all shaggy and kind of Larry David.
That's very sweet. I love that.
Yeah.
I have yet to, and maybe they were just being nice, but I have yet to meet a woman that really cares.
Yeah.
They just don't care. It's like if you're nice and you're funny and you're smart and you're respectful, then they like you. That's just it.
Yeah.
But it's not a thing. It's a thing that men, where they judge themselves. You know, and that in of itself is sort of interesting. Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted. Go ahead, Brian.
Oh, no. But it's, I mean, I guess the biggest point is like, and why overdoing this, the podcast, it kind of shifted a little bit. Just like, well, I mean, we're just talking about insecurities. Like everybody has some hang up. Like literally when I was in high school, before I started losing my hair, I was obsessed with my hands. I was obsessed with my hands were too skinny.
Oh.
And I used to get like one of those exercise balls to try to beef them up. And like I was doing.
Yeah.
Was
like literally, get the strong hands. Like,
and then
your hands are kicking up, you know, you're on the beach and big hands come over and kick dust, sand into your hands.
Yeah. When like, I walk, someday, if you see me from a distance, it just look like two Mickey Mouse giant gloves are kind of walking towards you. But and then it's kind of the salvation of someone who accepts you. My first girlfriend was like, I love your hands. Like,
they're nice. They're artist hands. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's strange that relationship you have to yourself through something that you are insecure about.
Totally. Yeah. I have actually a tremendous amount of insecurities. Part of it is growing up in I was the last kid, you know, of four. And and I always felt self-conscious. I always felt like I didn't know as much as everybody else. And mostly it's because I really didn't. But they were all...
They didn't teach you. They gave up on you.
No. I was like I was the dumb kid of a smart family. So, which I really... I joke about, but I actually really keenly felt. So I have a deep insecurity about how smart I am or not smart I am. And I can be unhealthfully competitive when I start playing a game because like I can be a bad sport and I know it in myself and I actually hate it in myself.
Yeah.
But it's because, you know, my brothers would teach me a game and then they would win. And and because I just couldn't pick it up as fast as they did because I was smaller. I was too young and it's nothing against them. They didn't rub it in. They're really nice guys. I would still lose. I always lost. And I just hated it. you know, I always felt like somehow it was stacked against me. When it's the same rules. It's just you're smaller, you're not as smart, you don't know the game as well because you just started. It's one of the things I hate that I do, and I have worked on, and I'm in my mid-50s. I've worked on in my life to try to be a better sport and to not take it personally when I lose, and not to get self-conscious about a game, and not to get angry. You know, we were on, as a cast, we were on Family Feud, which is very strange, and I really wanted to do Family Feud, and I got excited.
For which show?
For American Housewife.
Okay.
And we lost, and I was really mad about it. I was such a bad sport, and I was simultaneously angry that we had lost, and angry at myself for having taken it seriously. It's Family Feud.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
I disappointed myself. I was angry at myself for being a bad sport about it.
Has sort of the converse of that, or the other side of that, been that competitiveness has aided you in, you know, our line of work, which is very unforgiving and
it is very abusive? It is. It's interesting. I think that part of my drive is that competitiveness.
Yeah.
They always say, like, when you read the trades, it takes, you know, about 20 minutes to read and 2 weeks to recover, because it's all the projects that you're not in that you're reading about, and people that you knew. And especially when I was younger, and, like, you know, genuine friends of mine, like Dermot Mulroney, who was a fantastic guy, would get apart. I would be jealous. Like, we were competing in some way when we weren't. We were different, you know, we're just different people. And of course he would be considered for roles that I wouldn't be considered for. It's not like we ever read for the same role, but I would be competitive somehow in a really unhealthy, weird way. I mean, I think it was Christopher Hitchens that said, envy is the only sin that isn't any fun at all. You know, like, the rest are kind of great.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, what you just said is, I've had that exact same thing. And my hearing you say my reaction, like, when I go through it, is sort of like, well, I'm friends with this person.
Yeah.
And we have, I'm, you know, that's just where it starts. I mean, it stops for me. It's like, well, I'm friends with this person.
Yeah. So why am I thinking this is really unhealthy? Like, what? I actually genuinely like this guy. Like, he's one of my oldest friends. Why am I thinking this?
But, like, but even it's not even sort of like, I'm like, I'll be jealous and envious and happy. I will be happy for them, but I'll be saddled with those feelings for myself.
Yeah.
But the logic I have behind it is like, yeah, but I'm a contemporary and a friend of this guy.
Yeah, right. I should
be
working
as well.
We were at
the same theater together. I should be getting it too. Like, everyone should get this equally. Yeah. And it's not that.
It makes absolutely no sense.
Makes no sense.
Yeah, no, I've gotten very good about accepting, and I don't feel competitive in parts anymore. Like, it's something I actively worked on and got through, got to the other side of it, where, you know, I'll see, like, Patrick Warburton, for example. He and I were up for the same roles all the time. And I got around to just accepting Pat is really, really funny, and he's going to be great in this. And if they choose Pat, they're making a great choice. He's fantastic. Yeah. So it doesn't have to be me. And it's okay that it's not me. And my bills will probably be, I'll be okay. I'll probably be okay. Because as you pointed out, it's like, well, luckily, I knock on wood. But, you know, it's gone okay for me. So I have to let that go. And that took a lot of work. It took a lot of work.
Yeah, I'd like to ask about that, because how do you... One thing that I still struggle with, and I think it's interesting you talking about the competitiveness, because my reaction to, I had the same thing, like, and it reminds me, I did some bad parenting, I think, in not letting my daughter win games.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You were great Santini. You were like,
it wasn't even that. I was just like, well, we're just going to play, and whoever wins, wins.
Yeah.
And part of it was, you know, I was like, oh, this 4-year old, I should just fake it.
Yeah, right. Man. Yeah, I know. So, but yeah.
It's terrible. I misinterpreted it. And I was like, no, you will learn by the process of what it's like.
Right. So like, yeah, you think that. I did exactly the same thing. So it's like, I mean, it just happens. Plus, sometimes you want to turn them on to something that you're good at because it's something that you could share together. And I basically created the same situation that my eldest brother created with me in chess, is that he was on the Princeton chess team when he taught me how to play chess. I was never going to win.
No, of course not.
It was not going to happen.
He just blindfolded himself.
He was genuinely trying to help me learn. Yeah. At the same time, he couldn't, you know, he couldn't hide his light in a bushel. He just couldn't not win because he knew the game backwards and forwards. So it was almost impossible for him not to win. And so, I don't know, sometimes I think about that when I try to teach my son how to play a game I like to play. Here, we have a court. I know it sounds ridiculous, but we play pétanque. It's like bocce. It's like the French version of bocce.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's cool.
So every time I tried to teach
him. You're a Francophile, it seems like.
I was little and lived over there and blah, blah, blah. Oh, but nice. Anyway.
Let's go.
Every time I tried to show him how to play, I ended up playing really well, even though I genuinely tried, Brian, not to do well. But there was something in my hand or my body that was just like, now we're playing, man. We're going to play. We're going to knock him out.
Wow.
And it's like, oh, my God, what are you doing? He's 9.
I'm seriously trying to lose here. I'm just that good and you're that bad. That came out bad, too. I'm so sorry.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, competition, I backed off from it so hard. Oh. Like, I just was never competitive. And my daughter is the exact same way.
Oh, yeah.
Like, she just the exact same, just like, no. Yeah. That is putting myself on the line.
Yeah.
And so for me, hearing you sort of say, like, it took you a long time to kind of get around that, I have the same thing. Like, and I've tried to figure out what it is. It's interesting hearing you talk about it, because now I'm like, I think that my reaction to someone else getting something is a reaction to myself.
Yeah.
And it's this reaction to myself in that I don't like being in this competitive situation.
Yeah.
Even more so, I don't like that I didn't get it.
Yeah.
I didn't get it. Turn on myself. Like, that's the kind of worst case scenario that I'll go through.
Yeah. And part of it is like we exert a sense of control over something we have no control over by having that reaction. Instead of just letting it go because it's completely out of our hands. I mean, we've done basically everything we possibly can by going in the room or now self-taping, it's horrible, but going in the room and doing the best you can. And if I have a good audition, that's it. I've done it. That's everything I can do. I mean, all you can do is look at my resume, look at the past work that I've done, and then see what I did with the character, and then everything else is out of my hands. But we exert a sense of control over the process by the feelings that we have towards it. Like, our feelings could alter the events in some way.
I think
it's about that. I don't really know, obviously, because it's something very deep. Also, you know, the one of the problems with our particular profession is that we want it, and our self-worth, a lot of it comes from us working, because so other people have to basically give us our own worth. If we only see ourselves as successful or happy if someone else has given us something. So much of our life is powerless, and it's very frustrating that's the way that it is. I mean, that's why I really respect actors that create their own, you know, material, because they've turned the tables basically and said, you know, I'm going to do it, and then, you know, they do it, and it's amazing.
It's funny because I broke it down to my girlfriend. She's a painter, and so she has no. She's like, I don't understand how you make your living. I was like, I don't either. I was telling her about it, and I was just like, I think basically I just go on an endless series of job interviews.
Yeah.
And most people go on two or three in their lifetime and they'll get a job.
Yeah.
And so it's just this recurrent thing. And like you said, it is Everyone has to sort of put them, most everyone has to put themselves in some position to another person of like, there's something that you have that I want access to.
Right.
And we're going to, you know, create some agreement.
Yeah.
But our thing is like over and over and over again.
I bet.
And it's, I mean, even in scene work, you know, it's the same thing.
Oh, like, yeah, totally. But it's also like, you know,
but that's fun.
The average working actor, as far as the amount of auditions you have and then how many jobs you get, is essentially like the batting average of a pitcher. Like,
yeah,
it's you're batting 100. People are like, wow, that's amazing. You're doing great. And for a lot of people, the greatest stressful moments of their lives is when they're unemployed and looking for work. And we do that routinely. Even when we're at work, we're still looking for work.
Yeah.
And thinking about how that work can get me other work, which is not entirely unique, but it's fairly unique in as far as a career.
Do you do that? Because I don't think I do. Or I feel like when I have, whenever I try to be like, here I go, I'm going to be slick, I'm going to kind of, you know, whatever, it always ends up just like shoe in the mouth, just wrong.
So oh, I'm you just, mean as like business conversations or what are you saying?
I guess so. It just sort of that when I am aware that like, oh, I should talk to this person because I might, you know, stick in their mind later on, it just doesn't. It just doesn't flow for me.
It doesn't flow. Like I'm actually a great, this is one of the things that I did learn from my father, who I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. largely. When we moved back from Paris, we moved back to the Washington area. My father worked in politics and foreign relations. And he was exceptionally good at working a room and taught me how to do it because I just would, go in and watch him work, and he was remarkable at it. That's part of the job.
What would you say the essence of working a room is? High-fiving? Because that's all I do. Right? I just run around the room, high-five everybody, which is bad during COVID, but I don't care. I'll do it.
I think one of the best tips, and people have said this a million times, is that people love to talk about themselves. So the more that you can remember details of what they had told you before about themselves, bring it up, and ask them about that, then you can work your way through a room and everybody thinks you're their best friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, people just love to talk about themselves. It's no secret. It's pretty well known. But But at the same time, most people, when they work a room, they still talk about themselves rather than the eyes on the prize, which is that you want to ingratiate yourself with people, or at least to get them the sense that you're a good person and that you'd be easy to work with. And also, I'm just interested in people's lives.
Yeah.
So part of it has to be genuine, but there is also, I mean, you know, Hollywood is complicated, and there are also the shifting sands of growing up in the DC area taught me a lot about that, because you know, if you're on a successful show or in a movie that's just coming out and people don't know how it's going to do, that you're the most interesting person they've ever met. but then if you're not on a show and you need a job, you're dramatically less interesting. My dad used to compare it to, he used to say it's the magic hat. So when you have the magic hat on, everybody thinks you're magic.
Yeah.
But it's really, they're looking in your eyes, but it's the hat. And the hat, the hat comes off. And someone else can wear the hat. The hat itself is the thing. And so you're going to lose the hat. So understand that when you're wearing the hat, you're wearing the hat. And and it makes it easier.
Yeah.
It makes it easier because you take it less personally when people aren't as interested in you because you're not wearing the hat anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that just that relationship of having a need from someone else has always been problematic for me.
Yeah.
Just in terms of it has made me feel like I need to be a different person than I am. I think that's why I was sort of saying, like, when I've tried to do it or been conscious of it, it's conscious, you know?
Yeah.
And so I've just been, if I can hang out with somebody and chat with them, great, you know?
Yeah. I will say one thing that I've gotten really bad at, and COVID, of course, has completely wiped this out. But before COVID, talking over music at a party, like a lot of showbiz parties, they have stupid music or, you know, something going on. And it's so loud and I end up shouting And yeah. when I was younger, I didn't mind for some reason, but now, and again, this is pre-COVID times. I don't know what I would do now, but I just got exhausted doing it. Like, I just didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. And I would turn to my wife and go, I'm kind of done. Like, I want to stop shouting. I'm just done shouting.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I can't do those. I can't. I quickly blow out my voice.
Yeah.
Or I just can't hear. It just like hits in some decibel level. I'm like, I'm old. Yeah. Are you old?
Yeah.
Let's nod at each other.
Yeah. Like yeah. the one time I met Melissa McCarthy, who seemed extremely nice, was at a party with really loud music. And I couldn't hear her. And then then I kept asking her to speak a little louder, and she would right at the beginning of the sentence, but then drop off almost immediately. I still really liked her, and she was really nice. So I would just say very general things like, yeah, I hear that. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm right-handed.
Yeah, kids. Yeah. You know, kids.
Kids, right? The government.
Oh, man. Taxes. Woo!
Yeah, I went to go see a show last night, and it was so funny. What'd you say? Standing in line. I went to go see Jeff Tweedy. Do you know him?
Oh, yeah.
Wilco?
Cool.
Yeah, it was so good.
That's fun.
I love him.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. He's like one of my massive heroes. So I was just like, yee. And it was also one of the first few things I've done. We've been like really crazy, like careful.
Yeah.
My daughter actually got it last week.
She
was asymptomatic. No, but she was asymptomatic.
So she was okay.
And then went away in 3 days, you know?
Right.
So it was best case. But it was that thing of like, we're running. Oh, it caught us. It finally caught us. And it felt like a moral failure. You know, it did. And there was a certain competitiveness of like, shit.
Yeah.
I wanted to be one of the ones who dodged it.
Yeah. I think ultimately we're all going to. Because it's endemic. Yeah. It's not going away.
No.
It's not.
No. Totally.
So I really wish it would. But if Omicron, taught me anything, because I honestly thought before Omicron, I thought we were done.
Yeah.
I really genuinely did. And I was like,
oh man, there was
going to be dancing in the streets. But then Omicron happened. And I went, oh, right. It's just going to be here now. It's going to be here.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, we're triple vaxxed and the kids are triple vaxxed. Your daughter was a vax?
Yeah, everybody's vaxxed up.
So. Only on
Bald Talk. Ever heard of social media? We have, and no big deal, we are on it. Check us out on Instagram at Bald Talk Pod or on Twitter at Bald Talk Podcast.
Please make sure to like, rate, and review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
We don't care where you get them. Just get them.
No judgment. Wherever you get them. Anywhere. Anywhere.
Anywhere. Whatever. No judgment.
As long as you listen, we don't give a fuck. Only on Bald
Talk. Going back to sort of like pre-COVID, post-COVID social stuff.
Yeah.
I'm standing in line waiting for water because you can't just go up and get a dispenser thing. Everyone has to get like a cup of water and stuff. And I'm standing there and a friend of mine walks in and I was like, oh, it's Brad. And then he hugs someone else. And I was like, oh, it's him. And it turns out everyone in line. I knew like six people standing in front of me
who were all masked up and nobody recognized each other. That's so surreal.
That's like a dream.
Feels like a dream.
It was bizarre.
That's
like,
really
it was
bizarre.
Just this moment of like those two guys see each other and like, oh. And
everybody, we're actually friends. We know each other.
Yeah. I've known you for 20 years. And yet I did not know you standing here. And then my girlfriend, she was like, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this because, okay, so when we greet people, they pull their mask down, they say hello, and then they pull their mask back up.
Right, which makes no sense. She's like, it's already over.
Right.
Yeah.
And so she was like, okay, so we're endangering each other. And so she said, my first impulse was to blow her my mask and then as loudly as possible scream my name. So basically just throwing spit.
Just projectile spit. Yeah.
Yeah. She's like, I feel crazy. Everything feels crazy. I was like, yeah, this all feels
Are
crazy.
You guys finding like the re-entry to like seeing friends? We had dinner with friends that we've known for, maybe 27 years. And the other night, we went out to dinner And it was really fun. At the same time, having like a conversation felt foreign.
Yeah.
You know, like I didn't know quite how to do it. And it was really weird. Yeah. It's not like riding a bicycle, you know, it felt like, oh, so now instead of just thinking about what I'm going to say, I should listen to you and then react to what you're saying. Like I was training myself to redo it. And it's been a weird.
You're like a sociopath who's learning to.
Yeah, like a total psychopath.
Function amongst people.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm actually a super social person, but. Yeah. But my skills have been thrown off, and it's and again, I mean, you know, and one of the themes of this podcast is you know, is feeling self-conscious or that kind of, you know, thing, and that is definitely something that I am burdened with now. Like I don't know when to cut myself off sometimes. Like I talk too long and I can hear myself and I'm like, You ran out of points a while ago, so you should probably not keep talking.
Circling back to the same thing.
Yeah, it's time to listen a little bit, not keep talking. It's very, like I haven't felt that way, I don't know, since I was little, I guess.
It's tough because the other thing is, and, you know, of course we've entered into it during this conversation, is it usually, like, it's like the lean of the ship kind of takes you over to talking about COVID, to talking about, like, pandemic stuff, you know? Because it's as much as every person has their own experience of this, you forget that every person has their own experience of it. Because, I mean, for me, speaking for me, it's just like I've never been so sort of self-focused, self-family-focused, safety-focused for this long. Yeah. You know, while at the same time slowly integrating that into my life, that this is a normal part of daily living now for everyone.
Yes, the constant adjustment and readjustment. And it is certainly the most complicated time in my life. And I think we're going to spend a lot of time processing what we've been through for the last 2 years. Yeah. It's a lot. And the idea that we're supposed to just get on with it is kind of an anathema, because it's like, how are we supposed to do that exactly? Like
it's very pro-capitalism if we do.
Yeah, right. You know? Let's just get back to work. And it's like, the most important thing is that we get back to work. And it's like, is it, or is like, is our safety more?
Seems like our work is going to be pretty fucked up.
If we die or whatever, that's pretty much the end of as far as I know, that would be the end of work. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, you know, we as a family, we were very careful. We, of course, because we're better people than you, we have not gotten COVID yet. Brian, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, let my daughter know that she's a flawed
That's
person.
That's right. She's terrible. She's terrible.
Family shame forever.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been probably the most cautious of anybody that I know. You know, and it has been thanks to my wife, who has been really on top of it the whole time and has done an amazing job keeping us healthy.
Yeah.
And also taken a lot of the heat for keeping our health standards up, you know, because she is willing to be the bad guy and tell us, you know, things that we shouldn't be doing. And it's a huge burden on her.
I think I was the bad guy in my family.
Yeah, somebody has to be. And I'm grateful that it was. That she did it, because I don't know. If it were up to me, we'd probably be sick, because I would have taken it less seriously than my wife did. And you know, so far we've missed it. So I'm grateful to her and everything that she's done to keep us well.
How old are your kids?
My son is 18 and my daughter is 16.
Yeah, my daughter's 14, and so it was like it was going back into school.
Yeah,
where I was like, this is where it's going to happen, if it's going to happen. And I was very impressed that it took
this long,
several months.
Yeah. For a middle schooler, COVID would be really hard for a middle schooler, because you're just figuring out, I mean, like what we're talking about, the idea of a conversation, like how we talk, and you're really just figuring that out when you're, 12 to 14, because you're...
Oh, my God. Well, she started a new school.
Oh, wow.
So she started a new school for freshman year of high school. But she was going with a couple of friends of hers.
Okay.
Well, but so she, yeah, starting a new school and stuff.
Yeah.
So she's with all these people she's never met, yeah, who she only sees their eyes.
Yeah.
And so she had this thing where she went to the winter formal, and of her friends, she was the only one who asked a guy out.
Nice. Good for her.
And yeah, totally. And I was like, oh, should I get a ticket for, you know, so-and-so? And she's like, no, you don't. No, he's got his own ticket, but I'm not dating him. I'm not dating him. I don't like him, and I will never like him. And I was like, okay,
right, good.
We'll get clear into specifics, yeah, about, yeah, this, but accepting this situation. Yeah. And so I came to find out that she, you know, had been chatting with him and sort of like, oh, I think that guy's kind of nice, and was interested in him, but had never seen his face.
Right.
And then right before the dance, he like pulled his mask, yeah, down, and she was like,
oh no, that's not good.
She's not in. She wasn't attractive. Yeah, and so it's just like this.
Yeah.
You know, it's, yeah, such, of course, a strange, yeah, it's a strange, like, time.
Yeah. Yeah.
She basically had like an email romance. And then,
no, that's right. I mean, they, it's like text or something, or, you know, it's, you do have to, it's, yeah, you do have to work harder to charm people because you don't have your face to go, you know, look at me. So, uh-huh, yeah, I mean, it's going to be, for that generation, it's going to be like this weird sort of, I know that for me on American Housewife, we had a couple of crew members that didn't rejoin us. So we had, mm-hmm, new crew members, and I had only seen them with their masks on. And then we went to, before Omicron came out and everybody was vaxxed, we went to a party just because we didn't have a wrap party because of COVID. So when we all got together, and a couple of the crew members that I hadn't seen without masks, like, I couldn't stop staring at, because in my head, their faces looked really different. Like, I had created a face for them, which had nothing to do with their, yes, with them.
It's like when you see a DJ in real, yeah, life. Like, you're like, that's the, that's voice? What you, that's, look, Casey, like? Kasem?
No.
No.
That's not Casey Kasem.
There's no way. Yeah. I thought he's much taller.
Yeah.
Brown hair.
Yeah, no, it's strange. I mean, yeah, yeah. It's fascinating, the time of wearing masks. And also, you know, just that we all pick up so many micro signals in a face.
Yeah.
We register them, you know, a million, I don't know how fast, but like all our synapses are firing, looking up signals in people's faces. That's why when people have Botox or they have plastic surgery, they can throw off your perception of them, because there's something about their face that isn't moving like our regular facial recognition software, essentially in our head, is responding.
They become a sim that you're sort of talking to.
Right. So you're always like adjusting in your head as to figure out what they're thinking, because their face isn't moving in a way that we are literally conditioned to register. So we don't see our faces anymore. That we're depriving ourselves of an enormous amount of information about somebody,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah. To the degree where you can be standing in line with six of your best friends.
No, no, they're
not
there.
Know it.
They could be total strangers.
Just ghosts.
Yeah.
Ghost people surrounding, yeah, us.
And you know, yeah, one of the things, when I flew to go work, I hadn't gone through an airport in many, many years where, yeah, I wasn't recognized, mm, because of the Drew Carey show at the time, it was a long time ago now,
right,
was a very big show. So I was recognized all the time, especially going to airports for some reason. I don't know what I'm. Anyway, mm, it was like, I've forgotten what anonymity was like. And I don't like it. I don't care for it. I'm agin it.
Oh, really?
I'm agin it.
Interesting.
I actually really like, I mean, because, you know, it's like, if people don't like an actor, it's pretty rare that they come up and tell you that.
That's true. Yeah,
you know,
they just glare at
you. Yeah, they either ignore you or they don't recognize you.
They'll take a picture of you and not know, yeah, and post it.
That's right. Look at whether you're bald head or whatever. Yeah. But no, but it's unlike, let's say, for example, athletes, especially, mm-hmm, if athletes with, you know, teams in the U.S., let's say you play for Chicago or something like that, and your rival team, and you're in the airport, and somebody will say something really nasty to you, even though, yeah, you know, you're just you're a human being. You're waiting for a plane.
Just trying to move somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, really?
Yeah.
People do that. So yeah, I've actually seen it with, I'm not going to say who, but God, I mean, and he's a human being, and like,
yeah,
it's hurtful. It hurts, you know, you try to like, ha ha, you know, this guy's a whatever, but it still impacts you. And,
That's
but funny. People still feel like they, because it's like, oh, I'm an LA guy, so I'm going to yell at the Chicago guy. It's like,
yeah.
That's not the way. This guy gets paid to run a basketball up and down a court. It's not, he's not your enemy.
No, he's a gladiator in the battle that is ongoing. Yeah.
But anyway, but as an actor, it's like they like you. They come up then. And then I love it. I think it's great.
I do too. It's like, I will admit the little dopamine hit, the little sort of.
Oh,
like,
totally.
I'm just like, okay. I'm reaching beyond the sort of like limits of my own brain of like worrying who I'm impressing or whatever. And the other, but like, I always try to take it back to like, okay, that again, that's a good report on my business.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not just sort of like a coffee stand versus Starbucks. I might be like a Pete's Coffee or something.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. You know, it was fascinating when I first started getting recognized because I was in a movie, The Beverly Hillbillies, and I was on a show called Danger Theater. And both of them did badly. You know, they didn't get me other work. And it did basically like, they didn't even happen, really. It's like, just absolutely nothing happened. My career was exactly back where it was when it started. And I thought that I was going to be like, I was 25 or 26 years old, and a bunch of friends of mine had become movie stars. And I was like, oh, now this is what happens. You know, you just right? become a movie star.
That's the thing. Yeah, your friends are becoming movie stars.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, well, I'm in this group and everybody's becoming a star, so I'm going to be a movie star now. And then it didn't happen. And I did this one time. And I was with a friend, and we were going to a wedding in D.C., and a wedding of a friend, mutual friend. And we went to a bar next door because the party before, I don't know, we just felt like getting a drink by ourselves. So we walk over to this bar, and the guy comes up and says, you're the guy from the Beverly Hillbillies. And I said, no.
Oh, really?
I said I wasn't. And I only did this once in my entire career. And it's because at that moment, I was letting him know that it was a negative experience for me because I didn't get out of it what I wanted out of it. And I put that burden, my own perception of the picture, on him. And he was really disappointed. And my friend, who I was with, like looked at me and I was like, what? And he goes, why? Why would you do that?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, you're right. I did the wrong thing. I just did the wrong thing. And I went over to the guy and I explained everything to him. Like, I totally unburdened myself. I gave him way too much information. But I was like, it's just, I am looking for work right now. I'm having trouble finding work. The movie did nothing for me. The series did nothing for me. I mean, it gave me some money, but not much, frankly, because it was my first movie. And they don't pay very much. And then I had to try to make it ends meet for 7 months, I think, after the movie without doing any work because I couldn't get any other work. And, you know, I think I cleared like $20,000 for doing Beverly Hillbillies. And then I had to make $20,000 last for 7 months in Los Angeles, which is, not easy.
No, impossible.
It's really hard. This is a very expensive city.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't a happy camper. I really wasn't.
Yeah.
Hadn't worked out the way I had pictured it in my head. You know, I was too young to know that you can't control everything in your life. You know, there's just things that are going to happen.
I'm glad you had that experience and then got perspective on it. Cause I was on the other side. I was on the I'm disappointed side twice.
Okay.
One was with Jared Harris.
Oh.
I don't know if you.
Yeah.
And I'd seen him in this like indie film.
Yeah.
And it was when I was living in New York and he was at this little indie theater and I went up and I was like, hey, you're Jared Harris, right? I just saw you in so-and-so. And he was like, I'm not that person.
Oh, wow.
And I was like.
You are, though.
In his English accent and everything. Yeah, I was like, oh, really? And he's like, I'm not him. I was like, wow, you look a lot like him. He's like, I'm not him. And I was like.
Okay.
I was like, okay. Yeah. And then it bummed me out because I just sort of felt like I felt like he was saying fuck off.
No, he was. You know? He was. And it may have had, I mean, there must have been something else going on or he just, whatever. You don't know. But what I've learned is you just, it's a little like the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. It's like, when you see someone, they come up to you, all they want is to be seen. And and for you to fulfill an image that they have in your head, in their head for you, of you, I should say.
And it's a very vulnerable thing for them to
do. It is.
You know,
yeah, they're putting themselves out.
Yeah, because like you said, like they have an idea of you or what your job is and stuff. And it and this job is very mythologized for basically.
It's too mythologized. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but, completely.
But it is what happens. And so, and you're not going to change it by just saying that. So it is what it is. Yeah, I did that one time. And I'm really glad that I made up for it as best I could. And in a way, as you pointed out, like, I'm kind of glad it happened because, and I'm really glad my friend was there to give me perspective on what I had just done and how I had just been awful. I'd been terrible. And I learned from it. And now I realize that, you know, it's a gift of love. It's love. And they come up to you because they love you. I mean, not love you like they want to make out with you. They just, you've brought joy. And that's a gorgeous thing. And that's all they want to tell you is that you meant something to them. And all you have to do is accept love. And why is that hard? What's wrong with you?
Well, then it kind of goes back to like what we were saying, like what I was saying in terms of like my feelings about you having something wonderful.
Yeah, right.
It goes back to how I feel about myself right now in relationship to this.
Right.
And that was your same experience where you're just like, oh, you're kind of pointing out something that is sensitive for me right now.
Yeah.
But again, like that's a lot of backstory. I can sort of see if, you know, if you were like the 20th person or something, or this guy was like the 20th person who came up, you know, and you just didn't want to talk about Beverly Hillbillies. And you're like, oh God, this guy. But, you know.
Yeah. No. It was just what I was going through at that exact second. And I burdened the guy with my own thoughts. And it's like, you know, it's just if a stranger comes up to you and asks you how you're doing, why would you tell them that, you know, your dad just died? You know, that's not what the game is. And you,
but this is another thing because it goes back to working the room. Yeah. Like I used to be the guy who would do that.
Oh, really?
Like,
that's hilarious.
How you do it? I give an honest answer, honest answer. Yeah. So I quickly realized like, oh, they're not asking.
They're not actually asking you. Yeah.
They're just starting this dance for just a couple minutes.
Yeah, like that's it. That's all you need to do. That's all you need to do. Just keep dancing for just a short period of time. And if you can't do that, then really, why did you come to the thing? But I mean, you know, it is interesting human interaction.
The other encounter I had with
somebody denying,
there's another one where I came up and I won't say the actor, but I was like, hey man, I just saw you in this movie. I thought you were so fucking good. I know it came out a couple of years ago. I'm a little late, but I thought it really was amazing. And he looked at me as like, what am I supposed to do with that? And it was like that moment. Wow. And I was like, I guess you can shove it up your ass.
Yeah, I suppose you could just put it up your ass.
And I
you could also
off,
say thank you, like because it's just it comes from a nice place. It's not like I'm. Too,
but it was. Yeah. I mean, it was a very New York encounter regard. It was just like, hey, friendliness. Hey, you know.
Yeah.
Sour.
Bat it down.
But
yeah.
But it was like it was kind of like the other vert. I was like, oh, I've been here before, and I'm not gonna. You know, if you're sad, you don't have to shit on me.
No, you don't have to. You don't.
Put myself
you don't.
Out there.
And it's an easy trap to fall into. And I mean, I've worked with people who are uncomfortable with having a public career. And there's a part of me that is like, why do you think you get paid? You know, you get paid because people recognize you. And part of it is that you It obviously should come from a genuine place, but even if you're going to fake it, you should try to fake it because it's part of the career, you know, treating fans or anybody with respect. It's part of it. And I've never understood, like, why don't you want to do publicity? Why don't you want to talk about the show? Why don't you want to interact with fans? Why? I don't get it. Because it's like, that's why you get, you know, it's more than just that you memorize your lines and hit your mark. It's the whole package is the part of the business.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's fine. I think it's the times I've worked on something that I was like, oh, I hate this. I'm bummed out that I'm having to do this, you know, because I need a paycheck and stuff.
And get your insurance and all that. I mean,
Those I will completely, there have been a couple times where I will cop to being the asshole who's like snide about it, you know, in the interviews and stuff. Sure. And I look back now, I'm like, oh, dude, just be so grateful.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's not every, I mean, most people's jobs every single day is not home run
season. Oh my God. Are you kidding me? Like, I mean,
it's like most people are.
My dad did a really smart thing. I've been talking about my dad a lot on this, but my dad did a really smart thing. And he made me go work on a farm.
Oh yeah.
Virginia. And it, of course it taught me that I don't want to work on a farm, but because it's, we romanticize it, but it's an unbelievable amount of work. I mean, you know, you get up at 4 a.m. and then you work until the sun sets. And then the next day you do the same damn thing. You know, it was really genuinely hard.
How long was that?
It was a full summer when I was 16. And
term of service.
Yeah. So it was close to 3 months. And it was really, really hard. It also made me extremely grateful for my job, because I know it's not really, like, I'm having fun. I genuinely enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons that I keep trying to do it, is that I really enjoy it. I have very rarely not found joy on a set.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. But, you know, he taught me what it is to really work by sending me down there. And I resented the hell out of it for a while. But then... But then it did give me more, not to be too judgy to my old friends, but a little more drive than a lot of my friends. Because I didn't want to have a straight job, because it's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard to do something that you're not into.
Yeah.
And is really demanding physically and not mentally. And, you know, it's hard. And I didn't want to do it. So I've been eternally grateful to keep working in my chosen profession.
Did you went to School of the Arts in North Carolina, right?
Yeah, good for you. Yes, I did.
Yeah. I'm from North Carolina. I'm from Charlotte.
Oh, you're from Charlotte. No kidding. That's a nice town.
Yeah, yeah. My sister lived in Winston-Salem for a little while.
Oh, lived in Salem. Okay, cool. Yeah, yeah. I like Winston. I mean, you know, it's a small city, but I still liked it. Old Salem is really pretty. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I love Carolina. I think it's a great state.
Did you decide, like, early on? Like, when did you sort of decide to do acting? Or were you like...
I wanted to be an actor since I was about 4.
Oh, wow.
But then when I became kind of a hippie kid, I sort of lost track of that. Mm-hmm. And then I really wanted to ride a motorcycle to Tierra del Fuego. I told my dad that, and he... totally appropriately freaked out and said, well, are you going to apply for college at all? And I was like, I mean, why? I'm going to be riding a motorcycle. Tierra del Fuego.
I'm a free spirit, man. Don't hold me back. I'm going to be
doing my thing. He goes, how long does that take? And I was like, I don't know, maybe 3-4 years. I'm like around college time. And he goes, okay, so what can I do here? And I said, I don't know. What do you want to do? And he goes, how about you apply to one school? And I go, for you? And he goes, yeah, for me. And I go, all right, one school. Oh, one school. And he goes, but you have to try. And I go, okay, yeah, I'll try. I promise. And he chose North Carolina School of the Arts. And he did.
Interesting. So the deal was he could choose and then you will go there?
Or? If I got in, I would go. Yeah. That was the deal. I did not get into the full program. I got into the summer program. There I met the other most influential man of my life, Yuri Belov, a Russian director, acting teacher, who changed my life and became my mentor and was the first person to get teary talking about him. The first person to to single me out and say that I had talent. And because I didn't really, that's part of the reason that I lost my way was that I just didn't see anything. I wanted to create my own thing.
Yeah.
But essentially what Yuri was saying was that you already are your own thing. You're there. And he worked with me every day after class, before rehearsals, during that summer. And by the end of the summer, I had rediscovered that I wanted to be an actor.
That's so cool.
And he changed my life. And then I was lucky enough to get into school. I went there for 2 years. And then in between my sophomore and junior year, I met a casting director at a dinner party in Santa Fe. I was on vacation with my family. And she asked if I wanted to come in and read for the part. I was like, no, I'm going to be stage actor. And she said, just for the experience. Anyway, I got it. This Western. It was really fun. And I dressed like a cowboy and I rode a horse.
Oh, well.
And I really loved it. It's like playing pretend, you know, getting.
Yeah.
As Katie Mixon, who was the star of American Housewife and was absolutely wonderful person, said, I play pretend for a living. And that's the way it should be. It should be like playing. And when it's not, that's when I think you're not doing well, at least comedically, you're not doing the best work. But I mean, you know, it's like, I think we're very blessed to be able to make a living at this, you know, career.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, completely. I mean,
that was a kind of long way. I told you the whole like bio.
Oh no, I love it. I mean, hearing you say you got a mint, I remember when I was in college, because I have always wanted to do this, but I like kind of talked myself out of it over and over again in a way.
Sure.
And I played in a band I was a photographer, like kept doing other, and it was always creative stuff. Yeah. So I was like, all right, there's something I got to do.
Yeah.
But I remember going in college, I remember like aching for a mentor, like hearing you got a mentor. I was like, oh man, I remember just at being at that kind of juncture where I was like, I just need somebody. And I went to the theater department and they were shitty to me because I was in an English major. They're like, you have to dedicate your life to this. I'm just asking questions.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that stuff is so important because.
Can I tell one last story?
Can you tie in being bald to it somehow?
Somehow, just, yeah.
Yeah.
I had a bald teacher, Yuri Beloff. And,
great. Yeah.
You know, it was a little like Karate Kid when he's like has to polish the car and he's like this, and then the first time he does kung fu, he manages to block it really easily. But the whole time he's polishing the car, he's like, "Why am I doing it? It feels like I'm just like polishing cars." So one of the exercises Yuri did when, as I said, I used to see him every day before rehearsal in the evening. The exercise that started us, he started with he smoked. Unfortunately, that's what killed him. But so he'd take a cigarette, he'd take his pack. And his lighter, his glass of water or coffee or whatever it was. And he'd put it on a stool. And he'd say, okay, look at this. And I'd go and I'd look at it. And he goes, remember. And I'd go, okay. And he goes, turn around. So I turned around. And then he would rearrange it. And I'd have to turn back and put it the way it was. Mm-hmm. So it started off with like four things. But after 2 years, it became very elaborate. I had no idea why we would do this.
He sounds like he's preparing you for psyops or something. You know, like,
but I will say, my first close-up in show business, the actors as a hazing thing, they left the room. There were six of them in the scene, besides myself.
Yeah.
I was the last close-up. They finally got to me. It's often the case. The youngest actor gets the last close-up. It's totally fine. Right. It's part of the process. But they all left to haze me, right?
Yeah.
So the crew, to help me out, put different pieces of tape where they were.
Right.
And then the script supervisor read the lines. And I remembered where every single actor was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the director of that was one of the directors that had done Gunsmoke. He was around forever. Unfortunately, I can't remember his name. I'd have to look it up. Yeah. He's a fantastic old guy. He was in his 80s when he was directing me. But anyway, he comes up to me and he goes, kid, I gotta give it to you. And I go, what is it? He goes, they wanted to fuck you up the ass, but you turned it around on them.
Thank you, Hollywood stereotype.
All right, here's my cigar in my
hand. No, he was totally that way. Honest to God. I'm not exaggerating. That's the way he was.
Oh, that's so funny.
But then, you know, one thing throughout my career I've been able to do is continuity. Like, I'm really good at continuity. I do it all the time. And it doesn't seem like that would be an essential thing. Continuity, for those of us that are not in show business, would be like when I pick up the glass, take a drink, when I take a bite of food, when I put down my phone,
right hand,
if I do the right hand, when I do that, whatever. It has to match once they've decided that they're going to use a particular take in a master. It has to match in your close-up so that they can cut in between the two. Or the two-shot or the cover, even the coverage of the other person. Like if you were to put the glass down at the wrong time in somebody else's close-up, it screws up their close-up. So it's essential that you match yourself. Anyway, it's a skill that normally takes an incredibly long period of time to pick up. But I was ready to go because of Yuri Bell.
That's awesome.
It's one of those things. You never know what you're going to end up like needing. So
totally.
This was really fun.
Oh, dude, so fun.
It was really interesting to have this angle as somebody who's lost a lot of his hair and self-conscious about it to be able to talk about it in a way and not feel ashamed was a beautiful thing.
Oh, man, I really appreciate you being so open about it. And just in all things, it was a lovely conversation.
Yeah, I had a great time, Brad.
Listen, I still trump you in forehead, so just keep that in mind.
Which is difficult to do.
It is, yeah. I'm a real pro. Yeah. I'm a real pro in that regard. All right, dude, thanks so much. All right, everybody, stay bald. Bye.
Love it.
Someone to talk to. Brian and Charlie have a hairless party, and they are all there to invite you. No hairdos, no shampoos, interviews, only on Bald Talk.
Ever wanted to hear from the neighbor at 9 Cloverfield Lane? Or what if I told you that Dr. Loomis's worst patient wasn't Michael Myers? I'm Adam Peacock, host of the podcast My Neighbors Are Dead. Join me each week as I talk to the lesser-known characters from your favorite horror films. Each week is an all-new, fully improvised journey into the unknown featuring friends and luminaries from the worlds of comedy, horror, and beyond. New episodes every Tuesday on Campfire Media. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
Campfire.